from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, new research about why men have higher rates of cancer than women.
Females are protected from cancer to some relative extent because they have two copies of these genes, whereas males only have one.
Also today, an infrastructure proposal to President-elect Trump from the chief spokesperson for the Big Dig.
One advantage to having waited too long to do this is that we know what we need. We know what we have to build.
And a Massachusetts professor is threatened over her list of fake news sites. Plus, a new children's book about Georgia Congressman John Lewis.
There comes a time when you have to say something, when you have to make a little noise. Well, you have to move your feet.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Researchers have long known that men are more prone to cancer than women, but the reasons for that have not been clear. In a paper out today, though, Boston-based researchers find an explanation in men's genes. Here to tell us more is Carrie Goldberg. She's host of WBUR's Common Health blog. Welcome.
Thank you, Deb.
So I didn't realize that there was a difference in cancer rates between men and women. How significant is it?
So I think it's not very common knowledge, actually, that this gap exists, but it's a very striking gap. The American Cancer Society says nearly half of all men will get cancer at some point in their lifetime, compared to a little more than a third of all women. So it's significant. And it's not just because men have prostates and there's a lot of prostate cancer. This is true across most cancers, that men and boys get them more. Sometimes in some cancers, they get even double and triple. And overall, it's a 20% higher risk.
And so what have researchers been thinking were some of the reasons behind that?
Well, the reigning explanation has been that it's men's environment, which could include, you know, factory jobs that expose them to toxic chemicals, cigarettes, diet, drinking. But that hasn't been fully satisfying because, for example, why would this male bias in cancer hold true even for kids? I mean, they're not smoking and working in factories. So in this paper that was just published today in the journal Nature Genetics, some Boston-based researchers, they're from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, the Broad Institute, and Mass General, they report findings that suggest a very different explanation. And it's one that hinges on the X chromosome.
Okay, so I'm gonna try to remember high school.
Okay, good luck
here. Okay, females have two X chromosomes.
Correct.
Males, X and a Y.
Very good.
So there's something about not having that second X chromosome that makes men more vulnerable.
Right. So let's back up for a minute to the beginning. So I spoke with Dr. Andrew Lane at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He's one of the leaders of this new research. And he says his team dug into masses of data on cancer DNA that had been gathered over the last decade or so, trying to figure out what the differences were between male cancers and female cancers. And they were looking specifically for what's called tumor suppressor genes. They basically protect cells from cancer. Typically, cancers mutate or delete these tumor suppressor genes. Here's Andrew Lane.
When we looked across the whole genome, of which there are about 20,000 genes, the only genes that were mutated more frequently in male cancers than female cancers were on the X chromosome.
Okay, so wait, my high school biology, I thought I remembered correctly. X chromosome, women have two,
correct,
men have one.
Right, and so if you have two X chromosomes, you have two sets of tumor suppressor genes that are located on the X, right? So more protection from cancer. Except that it's not quite so simple because one copy of the X chromosome normally gets shut down in all cells. So the researchers were wondering, why should it make a difference if you have one X chromosome or two if only one can be working? But Andrew Lane says the answer seems to be that some genes on the X chromosome that are supposed to be shut down or inactivated are not. They're like escapees. They're like escaped genes from inactivation. They function anyway, and that means they can work against cancer.
Females are protected from cancer to some relative extent because they have two copies of these genes, whereas males only have one. So if they're going to get a cancer that those genes are involved, they have to mutate them twice, whereas males only have to have one mutation.
So one mutation and it gets you, right? So Dr. Lane says his team's calculations suggest that with some cancers, up to 80% of the gap between men and women could be related to mutations in these particular genes. Now, of course, there are other differences as well, like hormones, but still, this is looking like a pretty significant piece of the puzzle. Mm.
So let's talk about what that translates into. Mm-hmm. I know it's probably an early stage, but we do tend to think of men's cancers, prostate cancer, mm-hmm. women, breast mm-hmm. cancer. Mm-hmm. Could this research point to some kind of, I don't know, sex-based cancer treatments?
Yes, so possibly. Andrew Lane says the first step is just to make sure that in any cancer research, whether it's in the lab or clinical trials, there have to be enough males and females in the study so that you can see what's going on with their cancers genetically and how it might differ by sex. And he says that applies even to lab animals. You have to make sure you've got both females and males.
And is the thinking that this could soon be in doctors' offices?
Yeah, it could in time. And, you know, it fits in with this big trend of precision medicine in which the treatment is tailored to your genes, Dr. Lane says.
So if it turns out that males and females are much more likely to have one pathway or another mutated in their cancers, it could mean that even some of these precision type cancer therapies are more likely to benefit a male or a female.
So, Deb, we should emphasize this is not happening now or very soon, but the upshot is that eventually, you know, say you have two patients with the same type of cancer, a man and a woman, their doctor would know that their difference in sex could mean that the genetics driving the cancer could be different for each of them. So it's just like one more dimension that could be considered in the complex decisions that have to be made when cancer is being treated.
Okay, Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health. You can find a link to her story at our website, RadioBoston.org. Carrie, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
We've been looking at some of the campaign proposals of President-elect Donald Trump, and we've been talking with those who have ideas about how he might go about accomplishing them. Today, we're examining the first economic pledge that Trump made after he was elected this month, a promise that he made during his victory speech.
We are going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure.
Those words sent construction stocks soaring, according to the Wall Street Journal. And while the details of Trump's plan are in flux, we do know some things: that he plans to rely heavily on private financing and that he wants to cut what he says is regulatory red tape. There is widespread agreement that the nation's infrastructure has been neglected for decades, but how should the White House prioritize the work? Well, Dan McNichol has a few ideas. He's the former chief spokesperson for the Big Dig, and he was a White House advisor on transportation issues for President George H.W. Bush. He offered 10 ideas for Trump in a recent New York Times article titled "Trump's Size Idea for a New President: Build Something Inspiring." Welcome back, Dan.
Well, thanks for having me, Deb.
So some folks say we are in an infrastructure crisis. Would you agree with that? And would you agree with the level of infrastructure repair that Trump is talking about?
I believe we are in an infrastructure crisis. I think we've been in one for far too long. And I would like to think this is the beginning of an infrastructure renaissance that has not taken place. There's been many false starts to it.
Mm-hmm. So how much money? Of course, it always comes down to money. So how much money are you suggesting? Because there are a lot of estimates out there over what would be needed, when it would be needed. Do we talk about what's needed during the Trump presidency to end of 2020? Do we go beyond that? What would you say an amount might be needed in the years of a Trump presidency by 2020?
We are a massive nation with massive infrastructure needs and massive infrastructure complexes. I would say, and this is not an original thought, the American Society of Civil Engineers is putting out a number there of $3 trillion plus. Donald Trump's proposal for $1 trillion in 10 years, that would be a beginning. That would be a badly needed beginning.
But that's only a third.
Right.
So how do you think, and there's already a lot of fighting about where the trillion would come from. So, I mean, this $3 trillion number, is it even close to realistic?
I think it is. And it's not to get everything to an A-plus standard. It's meant to get things moving, mostly us in traffic. And Secondly, it's higher speed internet. It's more efficiency in the air with planes. It's all about movement. Almost all of that always we think of ourselves, but it's also the movement of goods, whether it's oil in a pipeline or water through water lines. Mm. It's all about freeing up the flow. Any great economy in the world is going to depend on infrastructure to support its foundations. It's the support of its societal institutions. And our infrastructure, I like to think, I don't like it, but I like to think that it's symbolic of the fractures and cracks in government. I'm not even sure. The more I look at this, the more I do this, the more I think our infrastructure is failing, but I think it's our political system, really, that is failing, and therefore our infrastructure is failing with it. I think the cracks in the bridges and the asphalt are indicative of the breakdown in our political system.
You know, a lot of folks certainly, including President-elect Trump, have commented on the infrastructure in places overseas compared to what's in the United States. Why is that? I mean, why does it seem as if many other countries have a much more advanced rail system, high-speed rail system, and other things than we do?
Because they do.
And why?
And that's a good question. The various reasons. In China, they skipped a whole half century and didn't build anything or much of anything. And then suddenly Deng Xiaoping launched China into the new age. The World Bank said he raised 450,000 people out of poverty by building roads. And roads leads to other forms of transportation like high-speed rail in China and subways in China. I spent a lot of time in China specifically. It's been exciting to watch the last 10 years. Sometimes horrifically, sometimes fantastically, they are building at enormous systems at very fast speeds of completion. They're subway systems. They have many, many milling machines down their building, Shanghai subway system. We might have two going on in New York right now.
Mm. And I'm just, again, if we go back to the affordability question, there are many folks who say that Donald Trump's financing plan for this has some holes in it, and they disagree with some of the suggestions that he's made about using the private sector and using private money and what that could mean to privatizing public functions and whether tax cuts might just benefit those who are in charge of the projects and not the folks working on the projects and the general public. I mean, how have other countries and other presidents in the U.S., remind us, how have they financed massive public works projects like this?
Well, in this country, our biggest massive public works project, the U.S. interstate system, up until recently the largest in the world, until China's interstate system, interprovincial system, eclipsed us. That was funded through a gas tax. Other countries have used private funding and public funding. We don't like to draw from our general fund often, and there's been a lot of fighting over that in the last 10 years. Who's going to pay for it? Is there going to be a gas tax? The old model seems to be broken for many reasons. The old model, the gas tax, people are getting much more mileage in their cars, so the gas tax is not giving what it used to give. People are using alternative energy for their cars, like a Tesla or a Prius, so that means there's no contribution whatsoever. But the private spend that Donald Trump seems to be focused on, that has a lot of possibilities, but it's appropriate and inappropriate. It's appropriate in some categories of infrastructure. It's inappropriate in others. Where I see it very appropriate and very successful, rail, transportation, places where you can get a meter and you can charge for it, often is attractive to the private sector because they can gauge how they're going to return their investment. Mm-hmm. And on things like water and schools, I don't think it belongs there. So it's a tough play, but around the world, Deb, 25% of infrastructure, for example, in Canada, is privately funded. So there's 100% of their public infrastructure, 25% of it is funded by the private sector. Mm-hmm. And we do about 1% here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge opportunity, even if you just double the 1 to 2, triple it to 3%.
But how do you make sure that private interests then aren't really benefiting and controlling something like this, which is supposed to be for the public, and running it as a profit motive?
Well, that's a very good point. The Indiana Toll Road was a disaster, and the people who launched that project privately ended up filing for bankruptcy, I believe. Mm-hmm. And Indiana takes that road back, and then they have control of it again. But what's a problem is sometimes these private ventures do look at it as a business, and they run it sometimes inefficiently as far as the public's concerned, more efficiently for themselves. But you want private sectors to be able to profit from this. You want them to be able to see the risk, see the reward, and go in there and make that project happen faster than it would have otherwise. One of the biggest crimes I see is a lot of badly needed projects that will never get built or get built 10 years or 15 years too late or later than they should. The sooner people can start using it, the faster the quality of their life will improve.
Now, you made a list in the New York Times of 10 projects.
Jim Stewart invited me to contribute to his article and asked me to come up with a list of 10 projects I would propose to Donald Trump.
Now, we should say your list includes California's high-speed rail project, which you're working on.
That's correct.
So we're going to get that right out in front. But the top of your list is actually another rail project. Explain, please.
Yeah, exactly. The Hudson River Tunnel. My cousin is a commuter from New Jersey, trying to get to Lower Manhattan and then up to the Upper East Side for his job, and has an app on his phone because the tunnel is so unreliable. Built in, I think, 1909, it's a tunnel that was severely, maybe even fatally damaged by Hurricane Sandy. It's anemic, to say the least. But future high-speed trains, we'd like to think, at least Amtrak train and commuter trains, would be rolling through that tunnel. And if you think of Manhattan as a financial capital to the United States, arguably the world, we need a lot better connection there. And cars are just not going to cut it. We don't need another GW Bridge. We need more rails. We need fast trains. China's delivering trains that travel at 300, 400 miles an hour. We need to think in those terms.
You also recommend the Miami Seawall.
You know, on the East Coast, there's just so much concern about another great flood, whether that comes from sea rise or whether it comes from a hurricane, a natural disaster. 99% of Miami, from what I read, would be underwater with a 5-foot sea rise. That's horrific. 99% of Miami Beach. And Miami, of all the cities and all the places on the coast, all those major cities on the coast, is probably the most susceptible. So I thought start there. But Mayor Bloomberg left his office with a $20 billion plan to do a protective wall around New York. New Orleans, after $15 billion, has it's like a medieval city. It's completely protected. And because of that seawall they built after Katrina, money is now flowing into New Orleans. Life is starting to look a little bit more normal in New Orleans. These levees are dumb. They don't have a lot of use until you need them desperately.
Mm-hmm. You know, we mentioned the Big Dig, which has become synonymous with huge government expense. Right? It cost a lot more than it was expected to. Also, bureaucracy. Were there lessons learned in that project that you apply to this list that you have now?
No, because I put all the prices down on the list. No, but yeah, we learned a lot of lessons on that project, and the list is very long. But in short, when you're taking on a public initiative like this, you have to have public support. And a lot of these projects have 50-50 support. That's not enough. And the reason they often don't is because there's not enough transparency, or at least not enough understanding and education about what a project will do. But I would say, very personally, I was a part of the group to show off the project, and I didn't think we got enough chance to show it off. The more people were allowed into the tunnels, the more they were allowed to walk on the bridge, the more they understood what we were building. And I think there was woefully little of that on the Big Dig. There should be more of that in future projects.
What kind of feedback have you gotten since this New York Times article?
Well, I was on MSNBC on Saturday for 5 minutes in the morning talking about this. I've been asked to speak in front of groups that are trying to figure this out, like we all are right here at this table. And it's got my publicist and publisher interested in doing a book, a memoir about a circumnavigation that I did in a 1949 Hudson around America, looking for infrastructure issues, trying to see if there really was a crisis during 2013 to 2015.
And you say, yes, there is. Yes, we need to fix it. Yes, Mr. President, this is what I think you should do. Have you heard from him?
I haven't heard from the Donald yet, but Jim Stewart from the New York Times heard from his spokeswoman the day the story came out, and she said, the Donald liked it. He saw it and he liked it. Okay. I think he likes to see himself as a developer, so maybe this is appeasing to his ego.
Okay. Dan McNichols, former chief spokesperson for the Big Dig and White House advisor on transportation issues for President George H.W. Bush. He offered 10 project ideas to President-elect Trump in a recent New York Times article titled Trump-Size Ideas for a New President Build Something. Thanks very much for being with us, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk with a Massachusetts professor who says she was threatened over her list of fake news sites. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The fake news stories that surfaced during the presidential election are getting all sorts of criticism from politicians, from academics, and even from the technology giants who featured those stories on their media platforms. President Obama warned about fake news stories in a press conference last week.
Particularly in an age of social media where so many people are getting their information in sound bites and snippets off their phones. If we can't discriminate between serious arguments and propaganda, then we have problems.
A Massachusetts professor also thinks that the fake news stories, usually on social media, cause problems for her students. So Merrimack College Communications professor Melissa Zimdars drew up a list of fake news sites to share with her students. She's with us now via Skype to talk more about it. Professor, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you as well. Did you see any fake news stories during this election? How do you tell if something is real or fake? Facebook and Google say they are taking steps to better review the information on their sites. Should they? And have you ever read a story online and later found out that it wasn't true? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Melissa, let's go to you first. For those who haven't seen your list of fake news sites, can you describe it and give us a few examples of who is on the list?
Sure. The first important thing to note is that it doesn't just include fake news. So it includes some fake news sites as well as others that are misleading or maybe could be considered propaganda, like Barack Obama says. Other sites may be clickbaity or they're satirical sites that could be circulated as actual news. Uh-huh. So one example of a fake news site would be 70news.wordpress.com, which is the sort of infamous site that was reporting Hillary Clinton lost the popular vote in the recent presidential election.
Uh-huh. Give us some examples of fake news stories that folks might have seen during the election as well.
Well, that's a major one. Others could just be different claims about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I'm having a difficult time thinking of one off the top of my head.
How about the Pope? The Pope endorsing Donald Trump.
Yes.
I mean, there were all kinds of stories, and I just want to jog people's memories of exactly what we're talking about here. They may not remember the site name itself, like 70newswordpress.com or something, but the stories they may remember. And I'm wondering, it's difficult, I think, to determine from a reader standpoint what is fake news. So how do you advise your students how to do that and others?
Yeah, so the first thing I advise them is just to read widely. So even mainstream journalism often is framed in particular ways and has particular biases. So whatever they're reading, they should always try to find other sources on the topic. There's other things they could do, just paying attention to the domain name. Usually a news website won't have .blogger or .wordpress in it. Mm-hmm. You can also look out for the style of the website. If they frequently use all caps to express particular emotions or to emphasize particular words, like Hillary Clinton destroys Donald Trump, normally that's a sign of clickbait or exaggeration, and you should keep on reading somewhere else.
So watch out for incendiary language, check the domain name. Those are all good pieces of advice. But it's my understanding a lot of these stories have some basis in truth, and then they're just exaggerated and sort of twisted to reflect a particular viewpoint. Is that typically the case?
Yes, and actually those are the sites that I am personally most concerned with, so less the outright completely fake news, and more the sites where there's a kernel of truth, but that kernel of truth is surrounded by a lot of false claims, or it's completely decontextualized from what happened, and those are often coming from a particular point of view, and they have a particular agenda that they're looking to serve.
Now, you posted this list of fake news sites, what, about a week ago, and you've had to take it down. Can you explain why?
Yes. I took the site down partially because it circulated much. I didn't think it would circulate at all, and it did. And I think it needs more information. It was something that I was able to talk through with my class. So without that, being able to talk through it, I want to make sure that it's serving the right purpose. And I was also increasingly concerned with some of the emails and Facebook messages I was receiving from readers of some of the sites on the list that were fairly violent and harassing.
You got violent messages and harassed. Like what? What would people say?
You know, that they would hope that I would be shot or even raped. Just very cruel things. I've also just been signed up for a lot of kind of troll-like things. Like, apparently I've been seeking plastic surgery consultations or test driving cars around the country. And that kind of stuff I don't mind. But the ones talking about physically harming me or my colleagues is disconcerting for sure.
Because you made a list of sites that you suggest folks should use when trying to discern whether something is real or fake news.
Yes. And so some of these websites kind of proved why they're on the list by encouraging their readers to, you know, to hack into my info or find info about me or contact me and harass me. And the way they reported on the list is mostly based in falseness. So they maybe have my name right, but they have my intentions completely wrong and a lot of other information completely wrong about me.
Hmm. Do you think, do those threats, does that suggest to you at all that maybe what we're talking about here is almost a cultural issue, that people just want to read things that they agree with?
I think there's definitely something to that. So just generally, we tend to seek out information and stories that already affirms our belief. And so when I'm challenging that, the response isn't for some people to think critically about what I'm challenging, but rather it's kind of causing them to dig in their heels a little further, saying that I'm trying to prevent the truth from coming out rather than encouraging a variety of reading to get at a greater sense of truth.
I want to remind our listeners that we are taking input from you as well here. Have you seen any fake news stories on social media? What should be done about fake news stories? How do you determine what you're going to believe, that what you read on the online media landscape, whether it's true or not? And should social media companies get involved, who should be the curator of this information? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. I'd like to go to Susan from Worcester, who's on the line. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I am a teacher as well, and I teach high school and middle school. One of the greatest challenges is I teach kids how to evaluate websites, but when they're on fake websites, they can't discern the information. So I've now had to completely change the internet, and I encourage them and I teach them about using traditional media, which is, you know, pre-internet, and how to use the information from traditional media sources, and those are the places where you're going to get, you know, accurate information, and not to use internet sites for news, and rather magazine site, you know, using databases to find traditional media articles.
Hmm. And that's very difficult, isn't it? I mean, what we know now is most young people get their news from social media.
Yes.
So
it is very challenging because they think that it's on the internet, so the internet is easy and it must be okay. And that's the greatest challenge, because it's not necessarily getting information they agree with. It's just being able to discern the information. And if they don't have any background knowledge, they can't discern if it's a true site. And I too have told kids about fake news sites, and I give them a whole lesson about fake information on the internet, and they kind of laugh and think that can't possibly be untrue. And so we're essentially creating a generation of kids who are not able to critically think and evaluate information.
Mm-hmm. And so when you say traditional media, I'm wondering how many are on that list? You don't need to list them all, but is it like a half a dozen traditional media companies, and you tell your students to only focus on them and others may be a little more suspect?
Well, I tell them, that magazines that are, you know, news magazines and traditional newspapers the major newspapers that we have, the newspaper of record, I explain to them what a newspaper of record means and the vocabulary that kids don't get, and to understand how the media has changed. And so I teach them at the traditional media source is, you know, what I used to do as a researcher. When I was in school, we didn't have the internet. So this is how I try to teach them that, you know, these are much better sources to use because of the accuracy. There's people that are checking it.
Mm-hmm.
There's an editorial content.
Right. Okay, thanks so much, Susan. Susan, thanks very much for your comments. I just want to make sure our lines are full. I want to get to as many calls as possible. And I also want to get to our next guest, Hiawatha Bray, who's the Boston Globe technology writer. And he is going to talk to us a little bit about the technology companies and what they've said about these issues of fake news on social media. Hiawatha, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So in your latest piece for The Globe, you wrote that companies like Facebook and Google could have cracked down on fake news sites years ago, but we're talking about big audiences and big dollars. How much money here?
Well, of course, because these companies have profited from allowing these guys to use their ad networks. They sell ads through the Google and Facebook networks, and as a result, Facebook and Google have, frankly, been complicit in helping to spread stuff that's absolute nonsense. I mean, just the other day, I was on my Facebook page, and there was this thing telling me that Billy Graham was dead. And, of course, he's not, thank God. He's 98 years old, but very much alive. But one of these fake news sites is actually advertising on Facebook that Billy Graham is dead, an absolute factual falsehood. And they've also put up something that suggested that Clint Eastwood was dead. And they've been doing this kind of things for years, and Facebook could have done more to stop it. But now, all of a sudden, they're finally taking action, and that's a good thing. The question is, can they do it without engaging in censorship?
Right.
If you don't want Facebook or Google or any of these other guys taking it upon themselves to say, we're not going to allow you to say anything at all. That is something, luckily, they seem to have no desire to do.
Now, Google and Facebook have said that they will bar sites that publish fake news stories from joining the company's advertising networks.
Right.
And Facebook employees reportedly say that they're forming a task force to see if and how they might better regulate information. Do you think these are effective steps, or are there other things they should be doing?
Well, I think they're trying to figure out what they can do. I wrote about this, these people, computer science students, at one of them is at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, that is trying to do something that they're also thinking about here, which is to try to come up with an automated way of looking at a news story and saying, can we rely on this? And what they're doing, they've created an extension that goes inside the Chrome browser called FIB, F-I-B. And what it tries to do is it's going to flag your Facebook page if a story on it is verified or not verified. It's not going to try to censor it. What they're going to do is go to these websites that are considered trusted websites. And if the story comes from a trusted website, they'll give it a verified tag. If it didn't come from a trusted website, they will go to Microsoft's Bing search engine and try to find the same story at some place that's considered trustworthy. And if they can't, then they'll say, this isn't verified, you might not want to treat it like it's gospel. That's the kind of thing that Facebook is also looking at. Not saying you can't say this, but flagging stories and saying, we're not sure this is true. And that's probably the direction they ought to go in.
I just wonder, some of the things that you've spoken about and that Melissa has spoken about as well, it seems like you're asking folks, I understand that people have to think critically, but as we all know, folks are really pressed for time. And I think that particularly people who are relying on instant information online and younger people, they expect it to be quick and they expect it to be there. Asking folks to take these extra steps to verify this information, is that realistic? Do you think they're going to really do that?
Well, I think they have to, and I don't think this is anything new. I mean, there is nothing new about the fact that you can't simply believe what you read in the papers. By the way, there's this hilarious and rather brutal piece that ran on this conservative website, the Free Beacon, Washington Free Beacon, where they are talking about fake news in the context of how the New York Times covered the presidential election. And they go through this list of New York Times reports that turned out to be absolutely wrong. And they're basically saying, look, if the mainstream media can make mistakes this big, why are you surprised that people believe fake news? Mm-hmm. It's a real problem. It isn't just about the technology of fake news. It's also about preserving the credibility of American journalism, which is really suffering partly because of the financial condition of American journalism. They can't afford to hire as many people to do as much in-depth research. American press is making more mistakes, getting more stories wrong, and that's going to make it easier for fake news to thrive. Mm-hmm. But it also requires that consumers start being more critical of all their news sources. But that's something you should be doing anyway.
Okay, I want to make sure we get some of our listeners in. Corey is calling from Brookline. Corey, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I was going to say, I really see it as a matter of effort. You can report the election. The last five, six years or so, you know, when I see fake news stories posted on Facebook, I typically Google it. If it's not a website that I know, a mainstream, you know, journalistic website, I Google it. I try to find out. Is this a blog? Is this a hoax? I mean, I might be biased. I don't know. I work in education. I work at a middle school. I was a full-time graduate student up until about a year ago. So it's pretty simple for me. You know, if I see something that looks a little sensationalistic or I don't see other credible websites reporting on it, I can decipher it. And I'm always surprised to see when I, even my friends and my news feed post certain things, and I'm like, that's a hoax. That's completely false.
So you've never been taken in. You've never been taken in by a fake news story.
No, I
think it's pretty simple.
I'm actually too embarrassed to, before I post something on my own newsfeed, I want to verify it. You know, I mean, I have colleagues that friends. For me, I wouldn't want to look like a jerk, I feel like. So I feel like it's pretty simple. I think I also think technology, it's so easy to click on these things and just people want to share. It takes a moment, I feel like. It really does. I mean, to me, it's like writing a paper, you know, works cited, you know, and I think that it's a minimal effort, you can kind of decipher what's real and what isn't.
Okay. So, all right, Corey, thanks so much for weighing in here. You think it's a relatively easy process. We shouldn't be fooled. So does that mean no censorship, Corey?
I do believe, you know, I think some censorship, you know.
Should Facebook take more responsibility?
I do think that, you know, stories that are grossly untrue, I mean, if it's for entertainment purposes, that's one thing. But, I mean, I feel like with this election in particular, where, you know, this is a very controversial election, you have people who are looking for things, even if they weren't untrue, they wanted to believe them. And I think, you know, in that vein, I think some censorship or maybe some type of filter to, you know, weed out something that's egregiously untrue might be beneficial. I do believe that.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to take another call here. Jim is calling from Merrimack. Jim, you're on the air.
Thanks, Deborah, and I'm glad you're covering this. For me, I mean, I certainly agree that within social media, these clickbait, fake, for-profit news sites are a severe problem. But I honestly believe that they're born out of a much larger problem that's developed over the last 15 to 20 years, which is for-profit, hyper-partisan media. There's a bunch of media companies out there that call themselves news, and I'm not going to name any names, but they exist on both sides of the aisle, that are pushing an agenda, and it is for-profit information. And if users don't take the time to go to sites like, you know, the Congressional Budget Office or the Bureau of Labor Statistics to verify some of the stories that are being pushed, then you really can't help them. You really can't. And I don't think it's the job of social media to filter out news which is coming through a profit channel for them. It's challenging, but I do believe it's a symptom of a much larger problem.
But it's all, you know, news has always been a profitable operation. And I'm not saying that money shouldn't be looked at. But I'm wondering what you think of the idea of trying to edit, if you will, censor, regulate the information on social media sites like Facebook and Google. And who should do that? Whose responsibility is it to make sure that unbiased information is getting out?
I certainly agree that, I mean, they should take some editorial responsibility for what's going up. And if they can verify that it's a fraud site that's scamming people out of money or things like that, certainly, yeah, I do think that they have an editorial responsibility there. But I don't completely agree that all media is for profit. If you go back 30 years, the network news divisions for CBS, ABC, and NBC were cost centers. They weren't profit centers for those networks. And they had a lot more journalistic integrity than what we see in the 24-hour news network that is purely for profit today. I think this has been going on for quite a while. It's just getting worse.
All right, Jim, thanks very much for being with us. I want to just give the last couple of minutes here to Hiawatha and Melissa. Hiawatha, first off, when you hear this from our listeners, what do you say about this? And do you think that technology companies can do an adequate job of regulating the information to try to make sure it's more balanced?
I don't think they should be regulating it in the sense of, for example, censoring it or anything like that. I think they have a responsibility to flag information which is egregiously false and simply say, hey, we don't know for sure whether you can believe this. A lot of harm, I think, might have been done by that whole trending topics controversy earlier in the year where Facebook got rid of human editors and let computers just put stuff out there based on how many people wanted to read it. Because back when they had humans doing it, they filtered out a lot of the dumber stories because humans said that can't be right. And now they're trying to do it with computers, and computers are throwing up a lot of bad information. I think Facebook is going to have to hire editors, ultimately, and start thinking of itself more as an information organization, but not to censor the stuff, just to flag it and say, here, you can read this if you want to, but be aware this may not be true.
Melissa Zimdars, you have said that all of this debate about fake news might help real news get better. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think if some real news sites started covering news in a more thorough way, or covering stories that affect people. For example, there's been a near media blackout of the Dakota Access Pipeline stuff that's been happening, and people are interested in it. My students didn't know about it, and they want to. So, you know, maybe people would turn less to some of the hyper-partisan or fake or clickbaity sites if traditional media was serving them better.
All right. Melissa Zimdars, Assistant Professor of Communication and Media at Merrimack College. Thanks for being with us. Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the business section of the Boston Globe. Thanks to you for being with us as well.
Glad to be here.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Democratic Congressman John Lewis has long been a voice for the civil rights movement. He was one of the leaders of the 1965 march from Selma to Montgomery, and he's worked on several grassroots and political campaigns. Just this past June, Lewis led House Democrats in a day-long sit-in on the floor of Congress to try to force a vote on gun laws. He said this.
Sometime you have to do something out of the ordinary. Sometimes you have to make a way out of no way. We have been too quiet for too long. There comes a time when you have to say something, when you have to make a little noise.
That's right.
When you have to move your feet, the time to act is now.
John Lewis is the subject of a new children's book by Jabari Asim titled Preaching to the Chickens, The Story of Young John Lewis. Asim is a professor of creative writing at Emerson College and editor-in-chief of The Crisis, the journal of the NAACP, and he's author of 5 books for adults and 8 books for children. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Deborah. Glad to be here.
So why write a story about Representative Lewis?
Well, he's always been a really fascinating figure to me. I mean, I guess I would have to say he's one of my heroes. And I had just done a book, or I was working on a book for children about Booker T. Washington, and I had a list of other people whom I thought would make good subjects, right? And I discussed them with my agent. They were all people that I admired a great deal, and we both arrived at, oh, John Lewis, he's terrific. Let's see what kind of story we can tell.
And what was it about his childhood that so fascinated you? Was it that he seemed to know early on what his gift was?
Yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it. And then also, I had been fascinated by a number of children's books that addressed the lives of historical figures, but focused on an episode from their childhood, and I knew I wanted to do that. And I had been very much enamored with his memoir, Walking with the Wind, and so I revisited it, and I remembered this anecdote that he told about preaching to the chickens as a young boy, and I said, that's it. Let's see what we can do with that.
Mm-hmm. In a book like this, in a children's book, and it's a beautiful book, by the way, and
thank
it's
you.
Such a lovely story, how do you decide how much you're going to tell children. You know, it's sensitive and sometimes painful stories of what folks have been through, and their stories are often the ones that move us the most, right? So
sure.
how do you decide how to tell those stories to children in an effective way and still a meaningful way without hurting them?
Yeah, well, the tension for me is you really want to tell the truth. You want to tell the honest truth. But you don't want to so discourage a young reader that they end up not finishing the book, that they walk away from it. And I guess it's the triumphant aspects of Lewis's life that I wanted to emphasize to young readers. I think for more mature readers, some of the struggles and ordeals that he endured might be more useful. Mm-hmm. But I thought in terms of younger readers, it would be better to focus on a hopeful note, on the ambition he had, even as a very small child.
Mm-hmm. What else did you learn about him, or what was most surprising, do you think, that you learned about John Lewis when you were doing the research for this book?
Well, I think it was less about John Lewis and more about my own ideas about the nature of leadership. Reading his memoir really forced me to sort of reevaluate what are the things that are most important in leaders. And I think this idea of selfless dedication that he exemplifies, as well as any figure from the 20th century or the new century, those are the things that I responded to. And I think have led me to admire him as much as I do.
Mm. And what do you think you learned about what it was like to be a young black boy in Alabama when he was
that only confirmed the many stories that I had heard from my own family. You know, it's as an African American, I have my own roots in the South. I like to say that my grandparents escaped from Mississippi, so I had heard a number of those stories. They weren't unfamiliar to me, but they resonated with me, perhaps because of that.
You know, John Lewis co-wrote a three-part graphic memoir of his life and his activism. It seems to be a fruitful time for books in about his life. Why do you think that is?
Well, one of the amazing things about him is that he is one of the last living members of what we might call the golden age of the civil rights movement. If you think of the six figures who were the architects of the March on Washington, he's the only one that's still with us. So he's like a living link to a pivotal point in American history. And he's also still at the forefront of a struggle that continues to be challenged by modern development, shall we say.
Mm. You know, as you mentioned, you've written several books. Another one, 50 Cents in a Dream, illustrated
yes.
book about Booker T. Washington's childhood. Why, what do you think these types of books, again, do? And what was the difference between that book and this book about John Lewis?
Well, I think one of the valuable things about focusing on them as children, on these figures as children, is that it can inspire children. And I think children of color, of course, respond well to seeing themselves reflected in pages. But I think children in general tend to respond well to hopeful stories about other children. So I want to continue, I think, to do kinds of stories about people whom we know for what they accomplished as adults, but sort of always kind of go back and show how they were before they became whom we celebrate.
Mm. If we go back to John Lewis for a moment, and we talk about preaching to the chickens and that scene, which is really powerful, and it's well done in the book, and it talks about his early skills as an orator. And well, tell me how you think those skills have helped him throughout his life.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting that I don't know if I had actually a really good sense of him as an orator. I had more of a sense of him just as a leader, as a historical figure. And then after reading his memoir, I made it a point of going to see him live at the National Archives in D.C. And it really kind of confirmed in a dramatic way the impressions I had. He was a phenomenal orator. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I saw the connections. I said, you know, I get why he's so good. He's been practicing since he could speak.
To the chickens.
Yes.
And what do you think overall, if you even have an intent, what would your intent be that you hope kids go away with after reading a book like this?
Well, you know, I hope they will come away with a good feeling, with the idea that being selfless, speaking for those who can't speak for themselves is, you know, it's a really valuable ambition and should be part of their goals as they think about what they want to be and who they want to be when they grow up.
Mm. What's your next project in the pipeline for a child? Book for children?
A couple of books. I have one under contract that's basically a survey of African American history for young readers. Mm-hmm. And the next picture book beyond that will be about Muhammad Ali.
Mm. Right. All right. Well, good. Well, keep us posted, as
Thank you.
Always.
I
All
will.
Right. Jabari Asim, Editor-in-Chief of The Crisis, the Journal of the NAACP, and Professor of Creative Writing at Emerson College. He's author of 5 books for adults and 8 books for children, most recently the book Preaching to the Chickens, the story of young John Lewis. The book was recently awarded one of the New York Times' Best Illustrated Children's Books of 2016. It was illustrated by E.B. Lewis. You can see some of the illustrations at our website, radioboston.org. Jabari Asim, thanks again for coming in.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.